This is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the tug of war over who controls the internet intensified. The FCC wants to ensure that all content providers are treated equally, consistent with the principle called network neutrality. Internet service providers like Comcast, Time Warner, Verizon, and AT&T say that the market will see to that. Tension's been mounting ever since a federal court determined in April that the FCC has no authority to regulate the internet. That means that theoretically, the ISPs can favor certain content providers with faster speeds for a price, or block them altogether. Thus, they can make or break a business or a news site. Think about it. How long are you really willing to wait for a website to load? Open internet advocates say that now both free speech and the innovation that fuels our information economy are at risk. The FCC vowed to work with the ISPs and content providers like Google to keep the internet free, an approach that FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski says does not involve regulating the internet.
It would preserve the freedom and openness of the internet. It flows from a deep recognition that one of the internet's greatest strengths, its unprecedented power to foster innovation and free speech, stems from the absence of any central controlling authority, either public or private.
Last week, the industry's negotiations with the FCC collapsed, but it seemed that the tug of war over network neutrality would go on because 900-pound gorillas were pulling hard at each end of the rope. On one side, the ISPs. On the other, the FCC and Google. But this week, Google let go.
In today's Tech Bytes, backlash over Google and Verizon's proposal to regulate internet service. The companies laid out their vision in hopes it can serve as a framework for Congress and the FCC in drafting new rules.
The two agreed that so-called wireline internet, which comes into homes and offices, should be left free and open. But they said mobile internet providers who service phones should be able to charge extra fees to content providers for faster service to customers.
No matter what the status is of the legality behind the document, the fact that the two major technology corporations involved in the discussion has backed this proposal means it could very well sway discussions about the future of broadband internet in the U.S.
The proposal offered by Verizon and Google demands transparency from the ISPs. No more secretly stalling or dropping movie downloads because they eat up too much bandwidth. When ISPs use wires to connect to the internet, they must also observe strict net neutrality. Any blocking or stalling would trigger up to a $2 million fine. But ISPs that supply wireless connections, say through mobile phones, may extract fees for faster service. That wouldn't necessarily affect your bill, but it would affect the speed or the cost of the content you want to reach. Also, wireless ISPs could block competitive services. And when new services come along, like remote medical monitoring, they can hike the price of those. All of this strikes at the heart of how every one of us will communicate or do business in the near future. But it's complicated. So, to distinguish among the parties in this high-stakes game, we'll try a time-honored oral device, the leitmotif. In the symphonic saga, Peter and the Wolf, Sergei Prokofiev assigned themes to Peter, the bird, the duck, the cat, grandfather, and the wolf. But assigning the bad guy theme in our story is tricky. Everybody thinks they're the good guy. So, in the interest of fairness, we're not assigning the wolf's theme. In our rendering, the net neutrality advocate Siva Vaidyanathan, who teaches media studies at the University of Virginia, is the bird.
If we decide that the only level playing field will be that wire coming out of the wall into our personal computer, we might find that we've relegated all the freedom in the world to the 8-track tape deck over the next 20 years. And that could be a terrible mistake.
Alan Davidson, Google's U.S. public policy director, is the cat.
Yes, I think both companies ended up making some compromises in creating this proposal. It's one idea for how to break the logjam that exists right now. And that's why, from our perspective, protecting an open internet is too important an issue for consumers to have it end in stalemate.
FCC Commissioner Michael Copps is the grandfather.
The way I see it, it's kind of a statement of intent that private parties are going to have more to say about the future of consumers' online experience than consumers themselves are, taking public policy out of the equation and kind of betting the whole farm on the future of the internet being the province of gatekeepers and potentially toll booth collectors.
Verizon ducked our requests for an interview, so we had to rely on CEO Ivan Seidenberg's public statements, as at the Annenberg School of Communications in April. Oh, and Verizon is the duck.
The short answer to your question on this net neutrality issue for us is we're concerned that government wants to regulate every conceivable issue that could surface on the issue of access, when in fact the market is going to eliminate those barriers over time in any event. They're going to do it pretty fast.
We have always had public policy that addresses the important national need of providing information infrastructure to every citizen in the land.
The FCC is Michael Copps.
And that's why we had postal subsidies for newspapers back in the early days. That's why we had free spectrum for broadcast. And to come now and say, we don't need to have that because this technology under the control of the private sector is going to take care and be responsive and provide the news and information our citizens need to make intelligent decisions for the future of the country. It's not happening. You know as well as I that we have fewer journalists, less investigative journalism in this country today than we had 10, 15, or 20 years ago. And we cannot afford just to sit back and think that some invisible hand is somehow going to make everything dandy swell and peachy fine for the citizens of our country.
There are very valid concerns that have been raised.
Google's Alan Davidson.
We understand that it's a very political issue and that there are a lot of people who would like to see more in it, and we really respect that. I think what's most important is that in the end of the day, there should be some protections for consumers. And we did feel that it was very important to have a real strong open internet set of protections on the wireline side. In fact, this is really the strongest proposal that we've ever seen a carrier network operator agree to in terms of protecting non-discrimination on the internet.
People are not fooled by Google's claim that this announcement is going to somehow preserve network neutrality.
Siva Vaidyanathan.
Because enough people understand that the real excitement, energy, and investment in this field is going to be in the mobile space and is going to be in those really cool experimental spaces like 3D video and medical data.
Soon, wireless will be embedded in everything we touch.
Verizon CEO Ivan Seidenberg said this in a speech in June.
Infusing intelligence into all our systems and presenting us with a whole new way to run a home or an enterprise or even a country. When it comes to innovation and communications, the U.S. has a clear, decided edge. The smartphone revolution is centered in the U.S. The creation of tens of thousands of wireless applications is a U.S. phenomenon.
If that's where the experimentation is going to be, we need it to be a place where the most creative, entrepreneurial people are willing to invent things and develop technologies without having to slide their cards and enter the Verizon building.
What's in this for Google?
That's a great question. When there's a level playing field over the classic internet, Google can win. Google knows that they have the best coders and the best vision for the open internet. So they fought for it justifiably for some time. In the mobile space, Google is just another telephone operating system company at this point. Google is in a close partnership with T-Mobile and a close partnership with Verizon and is starting to get involved in AT&T's business as well. And under those circumstances, Google knows that its greatest competitor is Apple. Apple's a completely locked down system. A lot of the advantages of the iPhone, the reason it works so smoothly and dependably under most circumstances, is that it is a closed lockdown box. And Google understands that it has very little leverage to open up that environment, nor does it really see a return in having an open network over the mobile space.
I asked Alan Davidson why Google and Verizon sought to shield wireless services from FCC oversight. How is it different from the wired net?
There's less bandwidth. There's a greater need for network management. There are more providers out there than we've seen in the wireline space. So there are reasons to think that wireless may be evolving in a different way and may need different kinds of applications of the rules. And then the other piece of this is that it is a political compromise. Our hope is that even under this proposal, there will be a path forward for openness and protections for consumers on both the wired and wireline side in the long run.
The funny thing is, the FCC could easily seize control of this situation. The court said that it had no jurisdiction over information services. All the commission has to do is vote to reclassify the internet as a telecommunications service, as it once was. And voila, problem solved.
I have been pressing pretty hard, saying, let's do this right away.
Commissioner Copps.
The longer it drags on, the more difficult it's going to be to get this accomplished, because you give powerful forces on the other side the opportunity to lobby and spend a lot of money trying to change people's minds. And I think we have the obligation as a consumer protection agency to do our job, and we can best do that by reclassifying these technologies.
So you just declare the war is over. Where are your commissioners on this? I mean, why haven't you done it?
I speak for one commissioner, and that's myself. I am obviously of the hope that we have a majority here to do that. If our town square is going to be paved with broadband bricks, then we better make sure it's operating in the interests of all of us and is not under the control of a precious special few.
But many in Congress oppose summary reclassification. They say they want the chance to legislate, though no congressional action is expected until 2011. Meanwhile, Google and Verizon are shopping their proposal around the halls of the Capitol, where they find doors oiled by millions of dollars in telecom campaign donations. With a huff and maybe a puff, they could very well blow those doors down. But that's another story. Coming up, how the official narrative of the dropping of the A-bomb was cemented by a partnership between Washington and Hollywood. This is On the Media from NPR. Hello, podcast listeners. I know you're out there. After all, this is the internet, totally transparent. I also know that you get what we're trying to do here at OTM. I also know that you know what you're supposed to do. And I know that you know that I know. So, if you haven't done it yet, and you can afford to, send us $10 to pay for the podcast. We need it. Just text OTM to 25383. The charge will show up on your phone bill, and data and text rates may apply. Let us know that you're willing to commit $10 to this enterprise. Text OTM to 25383, because we really want to know. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, many news outlets marked the anniversary of August 6, 1945, when the U.S. Air Force dropped the bomb called Little Boy on the city of Hiroshima, followed days later by the detonation of Fat Man over Nagasaki. Thousands died immediately.
The atomic bombs which fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki must be made a signal. Not for the old process of falling apart, but for a new era, an era of ever closer unity and ever closer friendship among peaceful nations.
President Truman spoke at the Navy Day celebration in New York City in October 1945. By then, thousands more Japanese were dying of a mysterious disease, though few Americans would learn about it because journalists were barred from the affected area. Chicago Daily News war correspondent George Weller was one of the first to slip into Nagasaki, and he wrote a series of articles. But he made the mistake of filing them through General Douglas MacArthur's Tokyo headquarters, where they were summarily spiked, unpublished until Weller's son found old carbon copies in his home 60 years later. The first sentence of one of Weller's first articles makes you wonder why MacArthur suppressed them. It read, quote, "The atomic bomb may be classified as a weapon capable of being used indiscriminately, but its use in Nagasaki was selective and proper and as merciful as such a gigantic force could be expected to be." Greg Mitchell has written a lot about the incident, and he told us a few years ago that Weller's first take on the story, which was to change radically, wasn't surprising given the context.
Well, of course, you have to remember this was at the end of World War II, and Weller and other correspondents had seen a great deal of death in the preceding years. And the atomic bomb seemed to be just a bigger blast, just a bigger bomb, because not much was known about radiation. And in fact, that's why MacArthur did not want people to go to these cities. That's why U.S. officials, starting then and going on for years and decades, did not want people to focus on the properties of the bomb that made it different.
Because they knew and no one else did.
That's right. So Weller's initial reaction changed when he actually went into the hospitals. And literally, the same day he wrote that, later in that day, he wrote a quite different account after seeing the patients in the hospitals dying a month after the blast.
Can you describe what he wrote about when he went to those hospitals and saw the impact of the bomb?
Well, he saw women and children and other civilians who were lying on the floor or lying on beds with their hair falling out with strange red spots all over them, in terrible shape. He called this Disease X because the doctors didn't quite know what it was. There were rumors about radiation. The little that people knew about radiation disease, this seemed to be it. And so he wrote about these people, and his second and third accounts that came out of Nagasaki were quite different.
And that last piece he wrote ends with a statement that Americans are due to arrive in Nagasaki to study the bomb site. And he then writes, quote, "Japanese hope that they will bring a solution for Disease X." Do you think if Weller hadn't discussed Disease X in that piece, that maybe it wouldn't have been censored?
It's hard to say because there was a clampdown on virtually everything going on surrounding these two cities. A day or two after he got there, the military brought in a small group of other war correspondents for a short tour, and their stories were then held up and were censored. And the accounts that they gave focused on the blast and focused on what had happened in the cities with no mention of dying people in the hospital.
Greg, you co-wrote a book titled Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial. What was most remarkable for you when you read these accounts for the first time?
Well, I think it was how Weller himself symbolized or represented the whole American and world experience with the bomb. There was his initial elation, in a way, seeing the effects of the bomb and how it may have produced the end of the war, and it was almost triumphal. But then when he learned, and then later the world learned, of the very special properties of this bomb and the fact that its poisons could be spread for many miles and even threaten the end of the world eventually, he had a very different outlook. He never became a real anti-nuker, but his whole experience, just in a little nutshell there in a few days, really captured a lot of what the American experience was in responding to the bomb.
Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We spoke to Greg Mitchell, then editor of Editor and Publisher, in 2005. This week, we spoke to him again about the atomic attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They were epical moments, and yet they are rarely represented by that great synthesizer of American experience, the feature film. Hollywood has churned through nearly every dramatic moment in history, but it's largely left one of the most consequential of the 20th century alone. Mitchell thinks he might know why. While doing research for an investigation of Hiroshima, he found documents detailing the role the U.S. government played in crafting Hollywood's first treatments of the dropping of the bomb on Japan, a film called The Beginning or the End.
The Beginning or the End is the personalized drama of the men and women who bent to their will the savage forces of nature to create the atom bomb. And the terrifying seconds in time when Hiroshima became a livid ball of explosive fire and blazing chaos.
The initial impetus for the film came from the atomic scientists, who were extremely alarmed about the future of nuclear energy and nuclear weapons in the U.S. But General Leslie Groves, who was one of the directors of the Manhattan Project, was given script approval, as was the White House.
The filmmakers obtained permission from the real people they intended to depict in the film, and they also needed permission of the U.S. government to film in places like Los Alamos. But why did they give script approval to the U.S. government?
Well, of course, this was just after World War II, so of course everyone was in a very patriotic mode, and MGM probably couldn't have imagined going up against the military or the White House. In fact, Truman gave them the title for the movie when they talked to him in the White House. And so I think partly they saw this as a great publicity thing. If they could get the president's backing, it would seem to be sort of official.
In the MGM trailer for the film, there is an MGM
spokesperson.
Inquiring reporter.
Inquiring reporter and actor, clearly, talking to audience members leaving the film, who are also clearly actors.
After all, the picture is based on fact and has official approval.
The truth never hurt anybody.
Nowadays, of course, that would be death for a movie. But back then, the idea that the government, which had built and used the bomb, was also endorsing this movie certainly would have been enticing.
What was General Grove's impact on the film?
One of his main goals was to downplay the impact of radiation. So there was a portion of the script that was rewritten to show that radiation wasn't that big a deal. Each variation of the script adhered more and more to the official Hiroshima narrative that there was no choice but to use the bomb, and that the president not only made the right decision, but there was really no controversy around it. And I think one reason why the filmmakers were so anxious to have White House approval was that they actually depicted the president in the film, which was a very, very unusual thing for Hollywood. Truman had demanded from the beginning that if he was depicted, he had to be filmed from the back or the side, so that, as he said, it wouldn't show my countenance in talking about the bomb. And even after all the revisions, numerous fabrications in the movie to help bolster the case for using the bomb, Truman still felt that it showed that he made the decision very quickly, that he had done it without a great deal of thought. They got a new actor to play Truman, reshot the scene, and in general, the new scene offers more of a rationale for using the bomb.
Like the picture, sir?
Well, it seems to me it doesn't make any difference whether I personally like it or not. There it is, the story of the atomic bomb. If it had to be told, you people certainly didn't pull any punches in telling it.
In March of 47, it was touted as basically a true story, quote-unquote, but it actually helped to cement some real mistruths.
Just in the Hiroshima attack itself, it showed the brave pilots barely getting through under attack from heavy flak from the Japanese. And no such thing happened. They just flew without any opposition and dropped the bomb. One of the planes in the attack, they changed the name on the side of the plane from boxcar to necessary evil. Which I love the blatant nature of that. In the explanation in the movie, both in what Truman says and what others say, continually talk about Hiroshima being basically one big military base, which is not true at all. There was a military base there, but 95% of the casualties were civilians, mainly women and children. He claims that they dropped warning leaflets on Hiroshima beforehand, which is it was completely false. The film also does not mention Nagasaki at all.
And you argue that this film had a real impact over how future films, and there were very few of them, dealt with the subject later.
I count only three, really. There was a second film in 1953 called Above and Beyond, which was the story of Paul Tibbets, the pilot of the Enola Gay, who dropped the bomb. And that film, very similar to Beginning or the End, it had official backing of the Pentagon. Tibbets and Groves were paid again for their cooperation. There wasn't another film really looking at this till more than 30 years later, Fat Man and Little Boy. And this was made by Roland Jaffe, the director who made The Killing Fields. And he attempted to raise questions. It was much, much more of a fair treatment. But unfortunately for Jaffe, he had cast Paul Newman as General Groves, and it kind of capsized the film a bit, even though he made General Groves in many ways kind of the bad guy. Paul Newman portrayed him so well and so attractively that the full message didn't come across.
The Beginning or the End was a reasonably successful film. It got mixed reviews. But did it actually have the impact of entrenching the narrative that the bombings were absolutely essential and couldn't have been avoided except at the astronomical cost of American lives?
I would never say it was the key factor. There was a lot going on in the popular culture and in the press and the media and all tending to feed into this narrative. You know, Beginning or the End, the irony is that it was originally conceived by the scientists as a counter to that narrative.
A cautionary tale.
Right. And the finished product, I think, was very disappointing to most of them.
In fact, you quote Leo Szilard, one of the architects of the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb, as saying, quote, "If our sin as scientists was to make and use the bomb, then our punishment was to watch the beginning or the end."
Some of the scientists, like Oppenheimer, as much as they wanted to make a cautionary tale, they couldn't resist the Hollywood glamour. They went on the set, hung out with some of the actors. There were some people who did deny giving their permission when they saw what was going on. Others gave their permission and couldn't, like Szilard himself, he gave permission and then he couldn't take it back.
Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Mitchell is a contributor to The Nation and co-author of Hiroshima in America.
We know the beginning. Only you of tomorrow, if there is a tomorrow, can know the end.
In the mid-1950s, two film canisters were found inside an East German vault labeled simply Das Ghetto. It was Nazi propaganda footage of Jews inside the Warsaw Ghetto recorded over the course of 1 month in the spring of 1942. There are horrific scenes of starvation, disease, and death mixed incongruously with staged scenes of prosperous Jews eating in well-stocked restaurants and attending parties. Israeli director Yael Herzansky tells the story of Das Ghetto in her new documentary, A Film Unfinished. She says that in a world saturated with grisly images, her challenge was to render the terrible truth within the propaganda palpable to modern viewers 70 years after the fact.
Today, as contemporary viewers who experience a bombardment of images, I believe we cannot see anymore. I mean, we suffer from a certain emotional blindness towards so many images.
You kept trying techniques to remind people that this was, in fact, real. You told the story by having actors read from the journals of Jews in the ghetto who wrote about the film crews coming in.
3 maja 1942 roku.
At 10 a.m., the propaganda crew arrived.
Zjawili się filmiarze z propagandy.
They started to take pictures in my
Zrobili
office.
Zdjęcia w moim gabinecie.
Then we hear an account from one of the actual German cameramen taking that footage.
I recall that I had to film a mass grave with many layers of corpses. I cannot say how many layers there were beneath the layer which I could see.
And then, I think most affectingly, we hear from survivors of the ghetto who are watching this footage for the first time.
Oh,
I remember that woman. She used to walk around with her baby in her arms screaming and asking for a piece of bread.
What was the most surprising reaction from the witnesses?
It was the moments in which the survivors were smiling. Only then I suddenly realized that they're watching now images from when they were young and still hopeful and longing to see their dear ones. So for them, it's not just about terror and fear, but also something familiar, something they miss, which is completely gone.
You noted that some of the footage from Das Ghetto has been used over the years in ways that didn't acknowledge that it was from a propaganda film in which many of the scenes were staged. Can you give me an example of how it was used?
There is one scene where we see a group of women naked, descending into a ritual bath. And I saw this scene in a Polish memorial museum under the title Jewish Life Inside the Ghetto. Now, this scene is anything but Jewish life inside the ghetto. First of all, the ritual itself of going into the water is done alone. It's one of the most intimate rituals in Judaism. These naked women were surrounded by uniformed men who are pointing cameras, maybe guns, at them. And when you realize that, only then can we see the expression on these women's faces. And I assure you that it would have been very difficult for you to identify this expression when you see it in the context of a museum under the title Ritual Jewish Life Inside the Ghetto. It's amazing, but the psychological mechanism just prevent us from seeing that.
You don't see it without the context.
Right.
There was some additional footage that was found in the late 1990s by a film researcher. How did those additional reels advance the story?
Well, it was the first time when one could see the many takes. So when we see starving children standing in front of a meat shop, staring at the meat as if the Jews inside don't let them eat. We have 7 takes of these children being brought to the window to stare at the meat. I don't know even why the first time was not enough. I mean, they're doing it exactly the same every time.
I want to ask you about your intent. As much as I take your point about this film proving that we can't trust what we see in film or photo, those kinds of messages seem to be overwhelmed by the starvation, the piled bodies. There were times that I felt that any actual discussion of the propaganda value seemed to be beside the point.
I was not trying to show that here there is a propaganda film that we didn't know about. What I was trying to show is that these images beneath the propaganda layer, which is the most superficial layer of the footage, stands reality in itself. No matter how much the cameraman thought he can control the frame, he could not control people's faces. Their gazes into the camera express everything that they felt and their very own identity. In those moments, which I slowed down because I wanted to emphasize these moments, we can visually feel how the cinematic manipulation encounters reality.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yael Hersansky is director of A Film Unfinished, which opens at Film Forum in New York City on August 18th. Coming up, the ghosts of journalists past, present, and future. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macworld.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting the 2010 Community Health Leaders, working to improve health nationwide at communityhealthleaders.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last month, a right-wing blogger caused a scandal when he posted a speech by a government official that was selectively edited to make her appear racist and unethical. It was slammed as yellow journalism. Of course, the term is just as frequently lobbed against the left because no matter where you sit on the political spectrum, it's agreed that being accused of yellow journalism is a powerful insult, conjuring all that's tawdry and manipulative. And so it's been since the term was coined during a New York City newspaper war between Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst at the end of the 19th century. But yellow journalism's durability as an epithet has obscured its origins and its accuracy, or so American University professor W. Joseph Campbell told us last year when we spoke to him about his book, Yellow Journalism: Puncturing the Myths, Defining the Legacies. He says that Hearst described his own particular style of journalism as, quote, journalism of action.
He meant that newspapers had an obligation to do more than just comment on the passing scene of news and events in the world, but to actually engage in making society, making the city, making the country a better place, and confront corruption in a very direct and forthright manner, do something about it rather than just to editorialize about it. A lot of newspapers today tend to be staid, boring, predictable, and those are the features that you would not typically associate with yellow journalism as it was practiced 110 years ago.
Are they going to get the truth in the Inquirer? Quickly and simply and entertainingly, and no special interests are going to be allowed to interfere with that truth. I'll also provide them with a fighting and tireless champion of their rights as citizens and as human beings. Sally!
Sally!
Yes, Mr. Kane?
Here's an editorial, Sally. I want you to run it in a box on the front page.
We all know that Orson Welles drew inspiration for the film Citizen Kane from the life of William Randolph Hearst. By 1941, when the film was released, Hearst had built and lost an empire that included the largest newspaper chain in America. But over time, the character called Kane has become so conflated with the man named Hearst that we tend to think of the movie as a biopic. The book, The Uncrowned King, The Sensational Rise of William Randolph Hearst, written by Kenneth White, separates the myths from the reality. White says that when Hearst took over the San Francisco Examiner from his father, it wasn't just his first real test as a newspaper man.
It was his first real test at anything, really. It was the first job he'd really had, and he'd been something of a failure as a student. He'd left Harvard under a cloud without a degree. But he takes over the Examiner and in a very short period of time manages to turn it around and make it the most exciting paper on the West Coast. It was a smart, well-written paper with courageous crusades and a real sense of public service.
So eventually, Hearst picks up and he moves from San Francisco to Gilded Age New York, where there is a ferment of newspapers. Can you describe the town?
There were probably 40, 45 newspapers at the time, daily newspapers, morning papers, afternoon papers, highbrow papers, lowbrow papers.
A newspaper could put out 7 editions.
It could put up as many as 20, 25 editions. They even had billboards around town with the latest headlines, and they kept updating that constantly. So it was hugely competitive. It brought in the best talent from around the world at the time. New York probably had 5 or 6 of the best editors in newspaper history, not only Pulitzer and Hearst, but Charles Dana, the legendary editor of the New York Sun, and Adolph Ox had just bought the New York Times, Whitelaw Reid at the New York Tribune, and James Gordon Bennett Jr., who sent Stanley in search of Livingston.
Where did Hearst first set up shop? Where did he get his reporters?
Well, he buys this little newspaper called the New York Journal, and it has a staff. He decides to keep a lot of the rank and file people, but brings in some of his best editors from San Francisco and some of his best writing talent, sports writers and columnists and editorialists. And within 3 months, his circulation has doubled, and people around town are all talking about him as a young newspaper genius. This allows Hearst to go around and start talking to some of the better journalists at other papers, including Pulitzer's, and begin luring them over to his shop. They wouldn't have left had he not already made a splash.
Let's stop here and talk about Pulitzer. His paper, The New York World, towered over the newspaper environment at the time. He was Hearst's arch rival.
Pulitzer at the time was everybody's arch rival. He was the king of the heap in New York journalism. He had the biggest paper, the biggest circulation. He had the biggest building in New York City, the World Building. It was the tallest commercial structure in the world at the time. That gives you some sense of what a big deal Joseph Pulitzer was.
And it gives you a sense of how bold William Randolph Hearst was, because the rivalry played out big time during the presidential election of 1896, when each publisher was backing a different candidate.
The election of 1896 is generally considered the most exciting election in American history. It was William Jennings Bryan and the Cross of Gold speech up against the Republicans and William McKinley. Pulitzer was the key Democrat editor in New York and in all of America, and he broke with Bryan over the free silver plank and left Hearst alone as the leading champion of the Democratic Party. He was hoping that Bryan would die and Hearst would die along with him. But the race got really close, and Pulitzer decided that he would, instead of attacking the Democrats, he would attack Hearst, saying that Hearst was only supporting the free silver plank because he'd make a fortune with his family's silver mines, which wasn't the case. His family actually owned more gold. But Pulitzer tried to make Hearst the issue of the campaign and failed rather miserably at it. And at the end of the campaign, Bryan loses, but Hearst has emerged with the highest circulation in New York and as the leading Democratic publisher in America.
So that was 1896. We get to 1898, and probably the biggest black mark against Hearst, at least historically, according to legend, he fomented the Spanish-American War of 1898 to sell papers. True or false?
Absolutely false. I think this is the greatest misconception in Hearst's life, that he was trying to get America to intervene in Cuba simply because he thought a war would sell newspapers. For Hearst, it was a philosophical issue. Cuba was fighting for its independence from colonial Spain. Hearst looked at America's own history, and he thought that the Cuban people had the same right to self-determination that Americans had had. And so he was on their side right from the outset.
So are we talking then about the history is wrong when it comes to motive, but not when it comes to action? The fact is, he did whip up people in order to get America into that war, even if he didn't do it to sell papers.
He didn't whip them up to get into a war immediately. After a year or two, as Spain's unable to put down the rebellion in its Cuban colony, Spain resorts to more and more desperate measures, and it begins to herd the civilian population from the countryside, which it believed was supporting the rebels, into what were effectively concentration camps, where they were left without food, without medical care, often without shelter, and they began to die by the tens of thousands and then by the hundreds of thousands. And Hearst thought this was an abomination, rightly so, and began urging Washington to intervene. Now, Hearst wasn't alone in this position at the time. Most of Congress, in a lot of international opinion, viewed the issue the same way.
So why do we think that Hearst did this as a cynical ploy to sell papers?
It was because by defeating Spain, America found itself in possession of the Philippines and wound up effectively at war with the Philippine people and with an independence movement there. And they got bogged down for decades. And as a result of that, the whole Spanish-American episode has tended to be in ill repute with historians. And looking at it retrospectively, Hearst was responsible for the war because he had been a leading voice in favor of intervention.
So a couple of years after the war, in the early 1900s, Hearst, like his father before him, became active in politics himself, not unlike Charles Foster Kane. You know, it's hard not to confuse the personality of Orson Welles's Kane with that of Hearst, because the movie looms so large.
Well, Kane's a cartoon-like caricature of a man. He's sort of hollowed out in the inside and forlorn and defeated and solitary, because he can't command the total obedience and loyalty of those around him. Hearst never recognized defeat. Peter Bogdanovich, who spent a lot of time with Orson Welles, pointed out that the story of Charles Foster Kane in the end more resembled Orson Welles' own life than Hearst. Welles was the boy wonder who ended his life alone and disappointed.
What's the most persistent, pervasive myth about William Randolph Hearst that you hope to correct with this massive doorstop of a book of yours?
I think the whole of the Hearst legend is based on his performance as a journalist, and it's generally considered that he was a failure in his chosen profession. I found quite the opposite, that he was an exceptional journalist and that he was perceived at the time as a young man as a journalistic genius, and there's every reason to believe that he was such a thing.
Kenneth, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Kenneth White is author of The Uncrowned King, The Sensational Rise of William Randolph Hearst. Some say we're returning to the old style of journalism. Others say that the new media, with its unprecedented interactivity and audience feedback, has ushered in a kind of reporting that is altogether new. The fact is, after all the conferences and anxious op-eds, we really don't know where we're heading. Longtime journalist and professor Lauren Giglione thinks that he may have found some answers in an unlikely place. Tasked with writing about the future of journalism, he decided to immerse himself in a genre he'd always disdained: science fiction, also known as speculative fiction. He found that when authors imagine with reckless abandon, their predictive powers often outshine the experts. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You begin your paper with a stirring defense of the genre of science fiction against its myriad critics. It seems hardly necessary to do that anymore, since so many scientists forthrightly declare that they were inspired as children by Star Trek. Have you been roughed up by academics?
Perhaps you're right. I mean, this started for me when I was guest curator for a Library of Congress on the history of the American journalist. And the library said, the last chapter must be on the future. And I started reading futurists, and then I started reading science fiction writers. I decided that the science fiction writers probably were more worth reading than the futurists.
Because as you quote Ben Bova observing in your piece, futurists could not have predicted the transistor because there wasn't any science to underlie it back in the early days of the last century.
Right.
But speculative fiction writers, science fiction writers, did. They predicted miniaturization all over the place because they just assumed it was going to happen eventually.
Exactly.
So let's talk about how speculative fiction has treated the news media. French writers distinguished themselves early, beginning with Émile Souvestre in 1846.
Yes, well, they extrapolated from the newspapers of the day to have a newspaper that would be one large spool of newsprint with type on it running through a village and going up to the third floor apartment and down to the street, and people would read this moving roll of newspaper. But they also anticipated, more dramatically, news on television and interactivity.
We should stipulate this is fully 100 years before television.
Exactly right. And the illustrations in the novel show people looking at a screen in their homes.
Albert Robida wrote The 20th Century in 1887. What was his vision?
He's the one who had the all-electric home with telephonographics, news bulletins delivered automatically through telephones. And he had wall-sized telephonoscopes, which were televisions that were interactive, so people could react to the news and communicate with other people who were seeing the news.
What a bizarre idea. Now, if we get to the American mid-century, we inevitably trip over Clark Kent. Does he have anything to say about the future of the news business?
For reporters, you know, the ability to see through buildings and see somebody is lying, that anticipates a lot of science fiction, which focus on the eye, a super eye that can tell us much more than the human eye can tell us.
But, of course, Superman comes by his superness naturally. In the 1979 film Death Watch, starring Harry Dean Stanton and Harvey Keitel, journalists are modified.
Yes. Roddy the reporter, played by Harvey Keitel, has a miniature camera implanted in his head so that he can watch human death occur. And at that point, death is no longer occurring. So this is a major news event.
Whatever I see, mysterious, terrifying, I just watch it and it's on film forever.
And then there's another similar kind of story where Maya Andreeva, the News One telepresence camera in Raphael Carter's The Fortunate Fall.
In 1996.
Right. She can transmit to viewers a holographic memory of interviews. And so the event is vivid and complete as if it's happening right there.
But before implanted cameras and transplanted memories, there was the indelible Max Headroom, a computerized reporter in the days before computer technology was good enough to actually depict a computer reporter. So he was covered in foam and latex, and he wore a fiberglass suit.
Max Headroom here. Actually, I'm not here because I live 20 minutes into the future. You want to join me here?
I thought it was interesting when you raised the notion of machines with bylines. It's kind of a repellent image, but also maybe a reassuring one? I mean, what could be more objective than a machine? Do you think that there's something in us as news consumers that might welcome a dehumanized news disseminator?
It may well be that people will say, oh, well, it's a machine, so it's not a left-leaning liberal wimp that's delivering the news. But whether the human being behind the machine is any more, quote, objective than real-life reporters that we're familiar with, who knows?
Let's talk about another image that science fiction writers came up with regard to news, and that is journalist-free dystopias.
Yes.
Like those described by novelist William Gibson, who created the cyberpunk genre, starting with Neuromancer in 1984. That is a world where all your information comes by and through, essentially, hackers.
Yes, and I think there are many people who would say today, well, gee, we don't need journalists. We can just go on the internet, and we are all journalists. So there's not a special class of professional that's necessary anymore. I don't believe it. The society depends on aggressive reporting. The world is extremely complicated and confusing. And so to get at the truth or a version of the truth requires real work.
Is there any prediction that struck you as more likely than another?
Oh, I don't know what's more likely, but I am intrigued about moving beyond the handheld devices. I remember hearing somebody who invented the handheld device talking about implanting various devices in the human body that might take care of delivery of news and everything else. So who knows where all of this is headed?
As you quote Einstein, if at first an idea does not sound absurd, then there's no hope for it.
Yes, I love that quote because I think it talks to this notion of the future is likely to be counterfactual and not built on what has just happened.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lauren Giglioni teaches at the McGill School of Journalism. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Alex Goldman, with more help from Brett Jaspers and Michael Chaplin, and edited by me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Please do. Or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Hello, pod people. You heard me before asking you to send us $10 by texting OTM to 25383 to help us pay for our podcast. You can also go to our website at onthemedia.org and do it there. It's incredibly simple, and we'd really appreciate it.